Section 2. The Medium of Circulation. A. The Metamorphosis of Commodities. We saw in a former chapter that the exchange of commodities implies contradictory and mutually exclusive conditions. The differentiation of commodities into commodities and money does not sweep away these inconsistencies, but develops a modus vivendi, a form in which they can exist side by side. This is generally the way in which real contradictions are reconciled. For instance, it is a contradiction to depict one body as constantly falling towards another and as at the same time constantly flying away from it. The ellipse is a form of motion which, while allowing this contradiction to go on, at the same time reconciles it. Insofar as exchange is a process by which commodities are transferred from hands in which they are non-use values to hands in which they become use values, it is a social circulation of matter. The product of one form of useful labour replaces that of another. When once a commodity has found a resting place where it can serve as a use value, it falls out of the sphere of exchange into that of consumption. But the former sphere alone interests us at present. We have therefore now to consider exchange from a formal point of view, to investigate the change of form or metamorphosis of commodities which effectuates the social circulation of matter. The comprehension of this change of form is, as a rule, very imperfect. The cause of this imperfection is, apart from indistinct notions of value itself, that every change of form in a commodity results from the exchange of two commodities, an ordinary one and the money commodity. If we keep in view the material fact alone that a commodity has been exchanged for gold, we overlook the very thing that we ought to observe, namely, what has happened to the form of the commodity. We overlook the facts that gold, when a mere commodity, is not money, and that when other commodities express their prices in gold, this gold is but the money form of those commodities themselves. Commodities, first of all, enter into the process of exchange just as they are. The process then differentiates them into commodities and money, and thus produces an external opposition corresponding to the internal opposition inherent in them, as being at once use values and values. Commodities as use values now stand opposed to money as exchange value. On the other hand, both opposing sides are commodities, unities of use value and value. But this unity of differences manifests itself at two opposite poles, and at each pole in an opposite way. Being poles, they are as necessarily opposite as they are connected. On the one side of the equation, we have an ordinary commodity, which is in reality a use value. Its value is expressed only ideally in its price, by which it is equated to its opponent, the gold, as to the real embodiment of its value. On the other hand, the gold, in its metallic reality, ranks as the embodiment of value, as money. Gold, as gold, is exchange value itself. As to its use value, that has only an ideal existence, represented by the series of expressions of relative value in which it stands face to face with all other commodities, the sum of whose uses make up the sum of the various uses of gold. These antagonistic forms of commodities are the real forms in which the process of their exchange moves and takes place. Let us now accompany the owner of some commodity. Say, our old friend the weaver of linen, to the scene of action, the market. His 20 yards of linen has a definite price, £2. He exchanges it for the £2, and then, like a man of the good old stamp that he is, he parts with the £2 for a family Bible of the same price. The linen, which in his eyes is a mere commodity, a depository of value, he alienates in exchange for gold, which is the linen's value form, and this form he again parts with for another commodity, the Bible, which is destined to enter his house as an object of utility and of edification to its inmates. The exchange becomes an accomplished fact by two metamorphoses of opposite, yet supplementary, character: the conversion of the commodity into money, and the reconversion of the money into a commodity. Footnote. As Heraclitus says, all things are exchanged for fire, and fire for all things, as wares are exchanged for gold, and gold for wares. F. LaSalle, De Philosophie Heraclitus des Dunkeln, Berlin, 1858. LaSalle, in his note on this passage, erroneously makes gold a mere symbol of value. End of footnote. The two phases of this metamorphosis are both of them distinct transactions of the weaver: selling, or the exchange of the commodity for money; buying, or the exchange of the money for a commodity, and the unity of the two acts, selling in order to buy. The result of the whole transaction, as regards the weaver, is this: that instead of being in possession of the linen, he now has the Bible; instead of his original commodity, he now possesses another of the same value, but of different utility. In like manner, he procures his other means of subsistence and means of production. From his point of view, the whole process effectuates nothing more than the exchange of the product of his labour for the product of someone else's, nothing more than an exchange of products. The exchange of commodities is therefore accompanied by the following changes in their form: commodity to money to commodity. The result of the whole process is, so far as concerns the objects themselves, commodity to commodity, the exchange of one commodity for another, the circulation of materialized social labor. When this result is attained, the process is at an end. Commodity to money. First metamorphosis, or sale. The leap taken by value from the body of the commodity into the body of the gold is, as I have elsewhere called it, the salto mortale of the commodity. If it falls short, then although the commodity itself is not harmed, its owner decidedly is. The social division of labour causes his labour to be as one-sided as his wants are many-sided. This is precisely the reason why the product of his labour serves him solely as exchange value. But it cannot acquire the properties of a socially recognised universal equivalent except by being converted into money. That money, however, is in someone else's pocket. In order to entice the money out of that pocket, our friend's commodity must, above all things, be a use value to the owner of the money. For this, it is necessary that the labour expended upon it be of a kind that is socially useful, of a kind that constitutes a branch of the social division of labour. But division of labour is a system of production which has grown up spontaneously and continues to grow behind the backs of the producers. The commodity to be exchanged may possibly be the product of some new kind of labour that pretends to satisfy newly arisen requirements, or even to give rise itself to new requirements. A particular operation, though yesterday perhaps forming one out of the many operations conducted by one producer in creating a given commodity, may today separate itself from this connection, may establish itself as an independent branch of labour, and send its incomplete product to market as an independent commodity. The circumstances may or may not be ripe for such a separation. Today the product satisfies a social want. Tomorrow the article may, either altogether or partially, be superseded by some other appropriate product. Moreover, although our weaver's labour may be a recognised branch of the social division of labour, yet that fact is by no means sufficient to guarantee the utility of his 20 yards of linen. The community's want of linen, and such a want has a limit like every other want, should already be saturated by the products of rival weavers. Our friend's product is superfluous, redundant, and consequently useless. Although people do not look a gift horse in the mouth, our friend does not frequent the market for the purpose of making presents. But suppose his product turn out a real use value, and thereby attracts money. The question arises, how much will it attract? No doubt the answer is already anticipated in the price of the article, in the exponent of the magnitude of its value. We leave out of consideration here any accidental miscalculation of value by our friend, a mistake that is soon rectified in the market. We suppose him to have spent on his product only that amount of labour time that is on an average socially necessary. The price, then, is merely the money name of the quantity of social labour realised in his commodity. But without the leave and behind the back of our weaver, the old-fashioned mode of weaving undergoes a change. The labour time that yesterday was without doubt socially necessary to the production of a yard of linen ceases to be so today, a fact which the owner of the money is only too eager to prove from the prices quoted by our friend's competitors. Unluckily for him, weavers are not few and far between. Lastly, suppose that every piece of linen in the market contains no more labour time than is socially necessary. In spite of this, all the pieces taken as a whole may have had superfluous labour time spent on them. If the market cannot stomach the whole quantity at the normal price of 2 shillings a yard, this proves that too great a portion of the total labour of the community has been expended in the form of weaving. The effect is the same as if each individual weaver had expended more labour time upon his particular product than is socially necessary. Here, we may say, with the German proverb, caught together, hung together. All the linen in the market counts but as one article of commerce, of which each piece is only an aliquot part. And as a matter of fact, the value also of each single yard is but the materialized form of the same definite and socially fixed quantity of homogeneous human labor. We see, then, commodities are in love with money, but the course of true love never did run smooth. The quantitative division of labour is brought about in exactly the same spontaneous and accidental manner as its qualitative division. The owners of commodities therefore find out that the same division of labour that turns them into independent private producers also frees the social process of production and the relations of the individual producers to each other within that process from all dependence on the will of those producers, and that the seeming mutual independence of the individuals is supplemented by a system of general and mutual dependence through or by means of the products. The division of labour converts the product of labour into a commodity, and thereby makes necessary its further conversion into money. At the same time, it also makes the accomplishment of this transubstantiation quite accidental. Here, however, we are only concerned with the phenomenon in its integrity, and we therefore assume its progress to be normal. Moreover, if the conversion take place at all, that is, if the commodity be not absolutely unsaleable, its metamorphosis does take place, although the price realized may be abnormally above or below the value. The seller has his commodity replaced by gold. The buyer has his gold replaced by a commodity. The fact which here stares us in the face is that a commodity and gold, 20 yards of linen and £2, have changed hands and places. In other words, that they have been exchanged. But for what is the commodity exchanged? For the shape assumed by its own value, for the universal equivalent. And for what is the gold exchanged? For a particular form of its own use value. Why does gold take the form of money face to face with the linen? Because the linen's price of £2, its denomination in money, has already equated the linen to gold in its character of money. A commodity strips off its original commodity form on being alienated, that is, on the instant its use value actually attracts the gold that before existed only ideally in its price. The realization of a commodity's price, or of its ideal value form, is therefore at the same time the realization of the ideal use value of money. The conversion of a commodity into money is the simultaneous conversion of money into a commodity. The apparently single process is in reality a double one. From the pole of the commodity owner it is a sale, from the opposite pole of the money owner it is a purchase. In other words, a sale is a purchase. Commodity to money is also money to commodity. Footnote. Every sale is a purchase. Dr. Quesnay, Dialogue sur le commerce et les travaux des artisans. Physiocrates, 1846. Or as Quesnay, in his Maxime Générale, puts it, to sell is to buy. End of footnote. Up to this point, we have considered men in only one economic capacity, that of owners of commodities, a capacity in which they appropriate the produce of the labour of others, by alienating that of their own labour. Hence, for one commodity owner to meet with another who has money, it is necessary either that the product of the labour of the latter person, the buyer, should be in itself money, should be gold, the material of which money consists, or that his product should already have changed its skin and have stripped off its original form of a useful object. In order that it may play the part of money, gold must, of course, enter the market at some point or other. This point is to be found at the source of production of the metal, at which place gold is bartered, as the immediate product of labour for some other product of equal value. From that moment, it always represents the realised price of some commodity. Footnote. The price of one commodity can only be paid by the price of another commodity. Mercier de la Rivière, L'ordre naturel et essentiel des sociétés politiques. Physiocrates. End of footnote. Apart from its exchange for other commodities at the source of its production, gold, in whosoever hands it may be, is the transformed shape of some commodity alienated by its owner. It is the product of a sale, or of the first metamorphosis, commodity to money. Footnote. In order to have this money, one must have made a sale. End of footnote. Gold, as we saw, became ideal money, or a measure of values, in consequence of all commodities measuring their values by it, and thus contrasting it ideally with their natural shape as useful objects, and making it the shape of their value. It became real money by the general alienation of commodities, by actually changing places with their natural forms as useful objects, and thus becoming in reality the embodiment of their values. When they assume this money shape, commodities strip off every trace of their natural use value, and of the particular kind of labour to which they owe their creation, in order to transform themselves into the uniform, socially recognised incarnation of homogeneous human labour. We cannot tell from the mere look of a piece of money for what particular commodity it has been exchanged. Under their money form, all commodities look alike. Hence, money may be dirt, although dirt is not money. We will assume that the 2 gold pieces, in consideration of which our weaver has parted with his linen, are the metamorphosed shape of a quarter of wheat. The sale of linen, commodity to money, is at the same time its purchase, money, to commodity. But the sale is the first act of a process that ends with a transaction of an opposite nature, namely, the purchase of a Bible. The purchase of the linen, on the other hand, ends a movement that began with a transaction of an opposite nature, namely, with the sale of the wheat. Commodity to money, linen to money, which is the first phase of commodity to money to commodity, linen to money to Bible, is also money to commodity, money to linen, the last phase of another movement, commodity to money to commodity, wheat to money to linen. The first metamorphosis of one commodity, its transformation from a commodity into money, is therefore also invariably the second metamorphosis of some other commodity, the retransformation of the latter from money into a commodity. Footnote. As before remarked, the actual producer of gold or silver forms an exception. He exchanges his product directly for another commodity without having first sold it. End of footnote. Money to commodity, or purchase. The second and concluding metamorphosis of a commodity. Because money is the metamorphosed shape of all other commodities, the result of their general alienation, for this reason it is alienable itself without restriction or condition. It reads all prices backwards, and thus, so to say, depicts itself in the bodies of all other commodities, which offer to it the material for the realization of its own use-value. At the same time, the prices, wooing glances cast at money by commodities, define the limits of its convertibility by pointing to its quantity. Since every commodity, on becoming money, disappears as a commodity, it is impossible to tell from the money itself how it got into the hands of its possessor, or what article has been changed into it. Non olet, from whatever source it may come. Representing on the one hand a sold commodity, it represents on the other a commodity to be bought. Footnote. If money represents in our hands the things we can wish to buy, it also represents the things we have sold to obtain that money. Mercier de la Rivière. End of footnote. Money to commodity, a purchase, is at the same time commodity to money, a sale. The concluding metamorphosis of one commodity is the first metamorphosis of another. With regard to our weaver, the life of his commodity ends with the Bible, into which he has reconverted his 2 pounds. But suppose the seller of the Bible turns the 2 pounds set free by the weaver into brandy, money to commodity. The concluding phase of commodity, money, commodity, linen, money, Bible, is also commodity to money, the first phase of commodity to money to commodity, Bible to money to brandy. The producer of a particular commodity has that one article alone to offer. This he sells very often in large quantities, but his many and various wants compel him to split up the price realized, the sum of money set free into numerous purchases. Hence a sale leads to many purchases of various articles. The concluding metamorphosis of a commodity thus constitutes an aggregation of first metamorphoses of various other commodities. If we now consider the completed metamorphosis of a commodity, as a whole it appears in the first place that it is made up of two opposite and complementary movements, commodity to money, and money to commodity. These two antithetical transmutations of a commodity are brought about by two antithetical social acts on the part of the owner, and these acts, in their turn, stamp the character of the economic parts played by him. As the person who makes a sale, he is a seller. As the person who makes a purchase, he is a buyer. But just as, upon every such transmutation of a commodity, its two forms, commodity form and money form, exist simultaneously but at opposite poles, so every seller has a buyer opposed to him, and every buyer a seller. While one particular commodity is going through its two transmutations in succession, from a commodity into money and from money into another commodity, the owner of the commodity changes in succession his part from that of seller to that of buyer. These characters of seller and buyer are therefore not permanent, but attach themselves in turns to the various persons engaged in the circulation of commodities. The complete metamorphosis of a commodity in its simplest form implies four extremes and three dramatic personae. First, a commodity comes face to face with money. The latter is the form taken by the value of the former, and exists in all its hard reality in the pocket of the buyer. A commodity owner is thus brought into contact with a possessor of money. So soon now as the commodity has been changed into money, the money becomes its transient equivalent form, the use value of which equivalent form is to be found in the bodies of other commodities. Money, the final term of the first transmutation, is at the same time the starting point for the second. The person who is a seller in the first transaction thus becomes a buyer in the second, in which a third commodity owner appears on the scene as a seller. Footnote. There are, therefore, four terms and three contracting parties, one of whom intervenes twice. Le Trône. End of footnote. The two phases, each inverse to the other, that make up the metamorphosis of a commodity, constitute together a circular movement, a circuit, commodity form, stripping off of this form, and return to the commodity form. No doubt the commodity appears here under two different aspects. At the starting point, it is not a use value to its owner. At the finishing point, it is. So, too, the money appears in the first phase as a solid crystal of value, a crystal into which the commodity eagerly solidifies, and in the second dissolves into the mere transient equivalent form destined to be replaced by a use value. The two metamorphoses constituting the circuit are at the same time two inverse partial metamorphoses of two other commodities. One and the same commodity, the linen, opens the series of its own metamorphoses, and completes the metamorphosis of another, the wheat. In the first phase or sale, the linen plays these two parts in its own person, but then, changed into gold, it completes its own second and final metamorphosis, and helps at the same time to accomplish the first metamorphosis of a third commodity. Hence the circuit, made by one commodity in the course of its metamorphoses, is inextricably mixed up with the circuits of other commodities. The total of all the different circuits constitutes the circulation of commodities. The circulation of commodities differs from the direct exchange of products, barter, not only in form, but in substance. Only consider the course of events. The weaver has, as a matter of fact, exchanged his linen for a Bible, his own commodity for that of someone else. But this is true only so far as he himself is concerned. The seller of the Bible, who prefers something to warm his inside, no more thought of exchanging his Bible for linen than our weaver knew that wheat had been exchanged for his linen. B's commodity replaces that of A, but A and B do not mutually exchange those commodities. It may, of course, happen that A and B make simultaneous purchases, the one from the other, but such exceptional transactions are by no means the necessary result of the general conditions of the circulation of commodities. We see here, on the one hand, how the exchange of commodities breaks through all local and personal bounds inseparable from direct barter, and develops the circulation of the products of social labour, and on the other hand, how it develops a whole network of social relations spontaneous in their growth, and entirely beyond the control of the actors. It is only because the farmer has sold his wheat that the weaver is enabled to sell his linen. Only because the weaver has sold his linen that our Hotspur is enabled to sell his Bible. And only because the latter has sold the water of everlasting life that the distiller is enabled to sell his eau de vie, and so on. The process of circulation, therefore, does not, like direct barter of products, become extinguished upon the use values changing places and hands. The money does not vanish on dropping out of the circuit of the metamorphosis of a given commodity. It is constantly being precipitated into new places in the arena of circulation vacated by other commodities. In the complete metamorphosis of the linen, for example, linen to money to Bible, the linen first falls out of circulation, and money steps into its place. Then the Bible falls out of circulation, and again money takes its place. When one commodity replaces another, the money to commodity always sticks to the hands of some third person. Footnote. Self-evident as this may be, it is nevertheless for the most part unobserved by political economists, and especially by the free trader vulgaris. End of footnote. Circulation sweats money from every pore. Nothing can be more childish than the dogma that because every sale is a purchase, and every purchase a sale, therefore the circulation of commodities necessarily implies an equilibrium of sales and purchases. If this means that the number of actual sales is equal to the number of purchases, it is mere tautology. But its real purport is to prove that every seller brings his buyer to market with him. Nothing of the kind. The sale and the purchase constitute one identical act, an exchange between a commodity owner and an owner of money, between two persons as opposed to each other as the two poles of a magnet. They form two distinct acts of polar and opposite characters when performed by one single person. Hence the identity of sale and purchase implies that the commodity is useless if, on being thrown into the alchemistical retort of circulation, it does not come out again in the shape of money, if, in other words, it cannot be sold by its owner, and therefore be bought by the owner of the money. That identity further implies that the exchange, if it does take place, constitutes a period of rest, an interval, long or short, in the life of the commodity. Since the first metamorphosis of a commodity is at once a sale and a purchase, it is also an independent process in itself. The purchaser has the commodity, the seller has the money, that is, a commodity ready to go into circulation at any time. No one can sell unless someone else purchases. But no one is forthwith bound to purchase, because he has just sold. Circulation bursts through all restrictions as to time, place, and individuals imposed by direct barter, and this it effects by splitting up, into the antithesis of a sale and a purchase, the direct identity that in barter does exist between the alienation of one's own and the acquisition of some other man's product. To say that these two independent and antithetical acts have an intrinsic unity, are essentially one, is the same as to say that this intrinsic oneness expresses itself in an external antithesis. If the interval in time between the two complementary phases of the complete metamorphosis of a commodity become too great, if the split between the sale and the purchase become too pronounced, the intimate connection between them, their oneness, asserts itself by producing a crisis. The antithesis, use-value and value, the contradictions that private labour is bound to manifest itself as direct social labour, that a particularised concrete kind of labour has to pass for abstract human labour, the contradiction between the personification of objects and the representation of persons by things, all these antitheses and contradictions, which are eminent in commodities, assert themselves and develop their modes of motion in the antithetical phases of the metamorphosis of a commodity. These modes therefore imply the possibility, and no more than the possibility, of crises. The conversion of this mere possibility into a reality is the result of a long series of relations that, from our present standpoint of simple circulation, have as yet no existence. Footnote. See my observations on James Mill in Zur Kritik, etc. With regard to this subject, we may notice two methods characteristic of apologetic economy. The first is the identification of the circulation of commodities with the direct barter of products, by simple abstraction from their points of difference. The second is the attempt to explain away the contradictions of capitalist production by reducing the relations between the persons engaged in that mode of production to the simple relations arising out of the circulation of commodities. The production and circulation of commodities are, however, phenomena that occur to a greater or less extent in modes of production the most diverse. If we are acquainted with nothing but the abstract categories of circulation, which are common to all these modes of production, we cannot possibly know anything of the specific points of difference of those modes, nor pronounce any judgment upon them. In no science is such a big fuss made with commonplace truisms as in political economy. For instance, J.B. Say sets himself up as a judge of crises because, forsooth, he knows that a commodity is a product. End of footnote. B. The currency of money. The change of form, commodity to money to commodity, by which the circulation of the material products of labour is brought about, requires that a given value in the shape of a commodity shall begin the process, and shall, also in the shape of a commodity, end it. The movement of the commodity is therefore a circuit. On the other hand, the form of this movement precludes a circuit from being made by the money. The result is not the return of the money, but its continued removal further and further away from its starting point. So long as the seller sticks fast to his money, which is the transformed shape of his commodity, that commodity is still in the first phase of its metamorphosis, and has completed only half its course. But so soon as he completes the process, so soon as he supplements his sale by a purchase, the money again leaves the hands of its possessor. It is true that if the weaver, after buying the Bible, sell more linen, money comes back into his hands. But this return is not owing to the circulation of the first 20 yards of linen. That circulation resulted in money getting into the hands of the seller of the Bible. The return of money into the hands of the weaver is brought about only by the renewal or repetition of the process of circulation with a fresh commodity, which renewed process ends with the same result as its predecessor did. Hence the movement directly imparted to money by the circulation of commodities takes the form of a constant motion away from its starting point. of a course from the hands of one commodity owner into those of another. This course constitutes its currency, cours de la monnaie. The currency of money is the constant and monotonous repetition of the same process. The commodity is always in the hands of the seller, the money, as a means of purchase, always in the hands of the buyer, and money serves as a means of purchase by realizing the price of the commodity. This realization transfers the commodity from the seller to the buyer and removes the money from the hands of the buyer into those of the seller, where it again goes through the same process with another commodity. That this one-sided character of the money's motion arises out of the two-sided character of the commodity's motion is a circumstance that is veiled over. The very nature of the circulation of commodities begets the opposite appearance. The first metamorphosis of a commodity is visibly not only the money's movement, but also of the commodity itself. In the second metamorphosis, on the contrary, the movement appears to us as the movement of the money alone. In the first phase of its circulation, the commodity changes place with the money. Thereupon the commodity, under its aspect of a useful object, falls out of circulation into consumption. Footnote. Even when the commodity is sold over and over again, a phenomenon that at present has no existence for us, it falls, when definitely sold for the last time, out of the sphere of circulation into that of consumption, where it serves either as means of subsistence or means of production. End of footnote. In its stead, we have its value shape, the money. It then goes through the second phase of its circulation, not under its own natural shape, but under the shape of money. The continuity of the movement is therefore kept up by the money alone, and the same movement that as regards the commodity consists of two processes of an antithetical character is, when considered as the movement of the money, always one and the same process, a continued change of places with ever fresh commodities. Hence the result brought about by the circulation of commodities, namely the replacing of one commodity by another, takes the appearance of having been effected not by means of the change of form of the commodities, but rather by the money acting as a medium of circulation, by an action that circulates commodities, to all appearance motionless in themselves, and transfers them from hands in which they are non-use values to hands in which they are use values, and that in a direction constantly opposed to the direction of the money. The latter is continually withdrawing commodities from circulation and stepping into their places, and in thus way continually moving further and further from its starting point. Hence, although the movement of the money is merely the expression of the circulation of commodities, yet the contrary appears to be the actual fact, and the circulation of commodities seems to be the result of the movement of the money. Footnote. It, money, has no other motion than that imparted to it by the products. Le trône. End of footnote. Again, money functions as a means of circulation only because in it the values of commodities have independent reality. Hence its movement, as the medium of circulation, is in fact merely the movement of commodities while changing their forms. This fact must therefore make itself plainly visible in the currency of money. Thus, the linen, for instance, first of all changes its commodity form into its money form. The second term of its first metamorphosis, commodity to money, the money form, then becomes the first term of its final metamorphosis. Money to commodity, its reconversion into the Bible. But each of these two changes of form is accomplished by an exchange between commodity and money, by their reciprocal displacement. The same pieces of coin come into the seller's hand as the alienated form of the commodity, and leave it as the absolutely alienable form of the commodity. They are displaced twice. The first metamorphosis of the linen puts these coins into the weaver's pocket, the second draws them out of it. The two inverse changes undergone by the same commodity are reflected in the displacement, twice repeated, but in opposite directions, of the same pieces of coin. If, on the contrary, only one phase of the metamorphosis is gone through, if there are only sales or only purchases, then a given piece of money changes its place only once. Its second change of place always expresses the second metamorphosis of the commodity, its reconversion from money. The frequent repetition of the displacement of the same coins reflects not only the series of metamorphoses that a single commodity has gone through, but also the intertwining of the innumerable metamorphoses in the world of commodities in general. It is a matter of course that all this is applicable to the simple circulation of commodities alone, the only form that we are now considering. Every commodity, when it first steps into circulation and undergoes its first change of form, does so only to fall out of circulation again and to be replaced by other commodities. Money, on the contrary, as the medium of circulation, keeps continually within the sphere of circulation and moves about in it. The question therefore arises, how much money this sphere constantly absorbs. In a given country there take place every day at the same time, but in different localities, numerous one-sided metamorphoses of commodities, or in other words, numerous sales and numerous purchases. The commodities are equated beforehand in imagination by their prices to definite quantities of money. And since in the former circulation now under consideration, money and commodities always come bodily face to face, one at the positive pole of purchase, the other at the negative pole of sale, it is clear that the amount of the means of circulation required is determined beforehand by the sum of the prices of all these commodities. As a matter of fact, the money in reality represents the quantity or sum of gold ideally expressed beforehand by the sum of the prices of the commodities. The equality of these two sums is therefore self-evident. We know, however, that the values of commodities remaining constant, their prices vary with the value of gold, the material of money, rising in proportion as it falls, and falling in proportion as it rises. Now if, in consequence of such a rise or fall in the value of gold, the sum of the prices of commodities fall or rise, the quantity of money in currency must fall or rise to the same extent. The change in the quantity of the circulating medium is, in this case, it is true, caused by the money itself, yet not in virtue of its function as a medium of circulation, but of its function as a measure of value. First, the price of the commodities varies inversely as the value of the money, and then the quantity of the medium in circulation varies directly as the price of the commodities. Exactly the same thing would happen if, for instance, instead of the value of gold falling, gold were replaced by silver as the measure of value, or if, instead of the value of silver rising, gold were to thrust silver out from being the measure of value. In the one case, more silver would be current than gold was before. In the other case, less gold would be current than silver was before. In each case, the value of the material of money, that is, the value of the commodity that serves as the measure of value, would have undergone a change, and therefore so too would the prices of commodities which express their values in money, and so too would the quantity of money current whose function it is to realize those prices. We have already seen that the sphere of circulation has an opening through which gold, or the material of money generally, enters into it as a commodity with a given value. Hence, when money enters on its functions as a measure of value, when it expresses prices, its value is already determined. If now its value fall, this fact is first evidenced by a change in the prices of those commodities that are directly bartered for the precious metals at the sources of their production. The greater part of all other commodities, especially in the imperfectly developed stages of civil society, will continue for a long time to be estimated by the former antiquated and illusory value of the measure of value. Nevertheless, one commodity infects another through their common value relation, so that their prices, expressed in gold or in silver, gradually settle down into the proportions determined by their comparative values, until finally the values of all commodities are estimated in terms of the new value of the metal that constitutes money. This process is accompanied by the continued increase in the quantity of the precious metals, an increase caused by their streaming in to replace the articles directly bartered for them at their sources of production. In proportion, therefore, as commodities in general acquire their true prices, in proportion as their values become estimated according to the fallen value of the precious metal, in the same proportion, the quantity of that metal necessary for realizing those new prices is provided beforehand. A one-sided observation of the results that followed upon the discovery of fresh supplies of gold and silver led some economists in the 17th, and particularly in the 18th century, to the false conclusion that the prices of commodities had gone up in consequence of the increased quantity of gold and silver serving as means of circulation. Henceforth, we shall consider the value of gold to be given, as in fact it is momentarily, whenever we estimate the price of a commodity. On this supposition, then, the quantity of the medium of circulation is determined by the sum of the prices that have to be realized. If we now further suppose the price of each commodity to be given, the sum of the prices clearly depends on the mass of commodities in circulation. It requires but little racking of brains to comprehend that if one quarter of wheat costs £2, 100 quarters will cost £200, 200 quarters £400, and so on. That consequently, the quantity of money that changes place with the wheat when sold must increase with the quantity of that wheat. If the mass of commodities remain constant, the quantity of circulating money varies with the fluctuations in the prices of those commodities. It increases and diminishes because the sum of the prices increases or diminishes in consequence of the change of price. To produce this effect, it is by no means requisite that the prices of all commodities should rise or fall simultaneously. A rise or a fall in the prices of a number of leading articles is sufficient in the one case to increase, in the other to diminish, the sum of the prices of all commodities, and therefore to put more or less money in circulation. Whether the change in the price correspond to an actual change of value in the commodities, or whether it be the result of mere fluctuations in market prices, the effect on the quantity of the medium of circulation remains the same. Suppose the following articles to be sold, or partially metamorphosed, simultaneously in different localities. Say, one quarter of wheat, 20 yards of linen, one Bible, and 4 gallons of brandy. If the price of each article be £2, and the sum of the prices to be realized be consequently £8, it follows that £8 in money must go into circulation. If, on the other hand, these same articles are links in the following change of metamorphoses, one quarter of wheat, £2, to 20 yards of linen, £2, to one Bible, £2, to 4 gallons of brandy, £2, a chain that is already well known to us, in that case, the £2 cause the different commodities to circulate one after the other, and after realizing their prices successively, and therefore the sum of those prices, £8, they come to rest at last in the pocket of the distiller. The £2 thus makes 4 moves. This repeated change of place of the same pieces of money corresponds to the double change in form of the commodities, to their motion in opposite directions through 2 stages of circulation, and to the interlacing of the metamorphoses of different commodities. Footnote. It is products which set money in motion and make it circulate. The velocity of money's motion supplements its quantity. When necessary, it does nothing but slide from hand to hand, without stopping for a moment. Le Trône. End of footnote. These antithetic and complementary phases, of which the process of metamorphosis consists, are gone through not simultaneously but successively. Time is therefore required for the completion of the series. Hence the velocity of the currency of money is measured by the number of moves made by a given piece of money in a given time. Suppose the circulation of the 4 articles takes a day. The sum of the prices to be realized in the day is £8. The number of moves of the 2 pieces of money is 4, and the quantity of money circulating is £2. Hence, for a given interval of time during the process of circulation, we have the following relation. The quantity of money functioning as the circulating medium is equal to the sum of the prices of the commodities divided by the number of moves made by coins of the same denomination. This law holds generally. The total circulation of commodities in a given country during a given period is made up, on the one hand, of numerous isolated and simultaneous partial metamorphoses, sales which are at the same time purchases, in which each coin changes its place only once or makes only 1 move, on the other hand, of numerous distinct series of metamorphoses, partly running side by side and partly coalescing with each other, in each of which series each coin makes a number of moves, the number being greater or less according to circumstances. The total number of moves made by all the circulating coins of one denomination being given, we can arrive at the average number of moves made by a single coin of that denomination, or at the average velocity of the currency of money. The quantity of money thrown into the circulation at the beginning of each day is, of course, determined by the sum of the prices of all the commodities circulating simultaneously side by side. But once in circulation, coins are, so to say, made responsible for one another. If the one increases its velocity, the other either retards its own or altogether falls out of circulation. For the circulation can absorb only such a quantity of gold as, when multiplied by the mean number of moves made by one single coin or element, is equal to the sum of the prices to be realized. Hence, if the number of moves made by the separate pieces increase, the total number of those pieces in circulation diminishes. If the number of the moves diminish, the total number of pieces increases. Since the quantity of money capable of being absorbed by the circulation is given for a given mean velocity of currency, all that is necessary in order to abstract a given number of sovereigns from the circulation is to throw the same number of £1 notes into it, a trick well known to all bankers. Just as the currency of money, generally considered, is but a reflex of the circulation of commodities, or of the antithetical metamorphoses they undergo, so too the velocity of that currency reflects the rapidity with which commodities change their forms, the continued interlacing of one series of metamorphoses with another, the hurried social interchange of matter, the rapid disappearance of commodities from the sphere of circulation, and the equally rapid substitution of fresh ones in their places. Hence, In the velocity of the currency, we have the fluent unity of the antithetical and complementary phases, the unity of the conversion of the useful aspect of commodities into their value aspect, and their reconversion from the latter aspect to the former, or the unity of the two processes of sale and purchase. On the other hand, the retardation of the currency reflects the separation of these two processes into isolated antithetical phases, reflects the stagnation in the change of form, and therefore in the social interchange of matter. The circulation itself, of course, gives no clue to the origin of this stagnation. It merely puts in evidence the phenomenon itself. The general public, who, simultaneously with the retardation of the currency, see money appear and disappear less frequently at the periphery of circulation, naturally attribute this retardation to a quantitative deficiency in the circulating medium. Footnote. Money being the common measure of buying and selling, everybody who hath anything to sell, and cannot procure chapmen for it, is presently apt to think that want of money in the kingdom or country is the cause why his goods do not go off. And so, want of money is the common cry, which is a great mistake. What do these people want who cry out for money? The farmer complains. He thinks that were more money in the country, he should have a price for his goods. Then it seems money is not his want, but a price for his corn and cattle, which he would sell but cannot. Why cannot he get a price? 1. Either there is too much corn and cattle in the country, so that most who come to market have need of selling, as he hath, and few of buying. Or, 2. There wants the usual vent abroad by transportation. Or 3. The consumption fails, as when men, by reason of poverty, do not spend so much in their houses as formerly they did. Wherefore it is not the increase of specific money which would at all advance the farmer's goods, but the removal of any of these 3 causes, which do truly keep down the market. The merchant and shopkeeper want money in the same manner. That is, they want a vent for the goods they deal in, by reason that the markets fail. A nation never thrives better than when riches are tossed from hand to hand. Sir Dudley North, Discourses upon Trade, 1691. Herrenschwanz's fanciful notions amount merely to this, that the antagonism, which has its origin in the nature of commodities, and is reproduced in their circulation, can be removed by increasing the circulating medium. But if, on the one hand, it is a popular delusion to ascribe stagnation in production and circulation to insufficiency of the circulating medium, it by no means follows, on the other hand, that an actual paucity of the medium in consequence, for example, of bungling legislative interference with the regulation of currency, may not give rise to such stagnation. End of footnote. The total quantity of money functioning during a given period as the circulating medium is determined on the one hand by the sum of the prices of the circulating commodities, and on the other hand by the rapidity with which the antithetical phases of the metamorphoses follow one another. On this rapidity depends what proportion of the sum of the prices can, on the average, be realized by each single coin. But the sum of the prices of the circulating commodities depends on the quantity, as well as on the prices, of the commodities. These 3 factors, however, state of prices, quantity of circulating commodities, and velocity of money currency, are all variable. Hence the sum of the prices to be realized, and consequently the quantity of the circulating medium depending on that sum, will vary with the numerous variations of these 3 factors in combination. Of these variations, we shall consider those alone that have been the most important in the history of prices. While prices remain constant, the quantity of the circulating medium may increase owing to the number of circulating commodities increasing, or to the velocity of currency decreasing, or to a combination of the two. On the other hand, the quantity of the circulating medium may decrease with a decreasing number of commodities, or with an increasing rapidity of their circulation. With a general rise in the price of commodities, the quantity of the circulating medium will remain constant, provided the number of commodities in circulation decrease proportionally to the increase in their prices, or provided the velocity of currency increase at the same rate as prices rise, the number of commodities in circulation remaining constant. The quantity of the circulating medium may decrease, owing to the number of commodities decreasing more rapidly, or to the velocity of currency increasing more rapidly than prices rise. With a general fall in the prices of commodities, the quantity of the circulating medium will remain constant, provided the number of commodities increase proportionally to their fall in price, or provided the velocity of currency decrease in the same proportion. The quantity of the circulating medium will increase, provided the number of commodities increase quicker, or the rapidity of circulation decrease quicker than the prices fall. The variations of the different factors may mutually compensate each other, so that notwithstanding their continued instability, the sum of the prices to be realized and the quantity of money in circulation remain constant. Consequently, we find, especially if we take long periods into consideration, that the deviations from the average level of the quantity of money current in any country are much smaller than we should at first sight expect, apart, of course, from excessive perturbations periodically arising from industrial and commercial crises, or, less frequently, from fluctuations in the value of money. The law that the quantity of the circulating medium is determined by the sum of the prices of the commodity circulating and the average velocity of currency may also be stated as follows. Given the sum of the values of commodities and the average rapidity of their metamorphoses, the quantity of precious metal, current as money, depends on the value of that precious metal. The erroneous opinion that it is, on the contrary, prices that are determined by the quantity of the circulating medium, and that the latter depends on the quantity of the precious metals in a country, this opinion was based by those who first held it on the absurd hypothesis that commodities are without a price and money without a value when they first enter into circulation, and that once in circulation, an aliquot part of the medley of commodities is exchanged for an aliquot part of the heap of precious metals. Footnote. There is a certain measure and proportion of money requisite to drive the trade of a nation, more or less than which would prejudice the same, just as there is a certain proportion of farthings necessary in a small retail trade to change silver money, and to even such reckonings as cannot be adjusted with the smallest silver pieces. Now, as the proportion of the number of farthings requisite in commerce is to be taken from the number of people, the frequency of their exchanges, as also and principally from the value of the smallest silver pieces of money, so in like manner the proportion of money, gold and silver specie, requisite in our trade, is to be likewise taken from the frequency of commutations and from the bigness of the payments. William Petty, A Treatise of Taxes and Contributions, 1667. The theory of Hume was defended against the attacks of J. Stuart and others by A. Young in his Political Arithmetic, 1774, in which work there is a special chapter entitled Prices Depend on Quantity of Money. I have stated in Zur Kritik, etc., he, Adam Smith, passes over without remark the question as to the quantity of coin in circulation, and treats money quite wrongly as a mere commodity. This statement applies only in so far as Adam Smith, ex officio, treats of money. Now and then, however, as in his criticism of the earlier systems of political economy, he takes the right view. The quantity of coin in every country is regulated by the value of the commodities which are to be circulated by it. The value of the goods annually bought and sold in any country requires a certain quantity of money to circulate and distribute them to their proper consumers, and can give employment to no more. The channel of circulation necessarily draws to itself a sum sufficient to fill it, and never admits any more. Wealth of Nations, Book 4, Chapter 1. In like manner, ex officio, he opens his work with an apotheosis on the division of labour. Afterwards, in the last book, which treats of the sources of public revenue, he occasionally repeats the denunciations of the division of labour made by his teacher, A. Ferguson. End of footnote. Footnote. The prices of things will certainly rise in every nation as the gold and silver increase amongst the people, and consequently, where the gold and silver decrease in any nation, the prices of all things must fall proportionately to such decrease of money. Jacob Vanderlint, Money Answers All Things, 1734. A careful comparison of this book with Hume's Essays proves to my mind without doubt that Hume was acquainted with and made use of Vanderlint's work, which is certainly an important one. The opinion that prices are determined by the quantity of the circulating medium was also held by Barbon and other much earlier writers. "No inconvenience," says Vanderlint, "can arise by an unrestrained trade, but a very great advantage, since, if the cash of the nation be decreased by it, which prohibitions are designed to prevent, those nations that get the cash will certainly find everything advance in price as the cash increases amongst them, and our manufactures, and everything else, will soon become so moderate as to turn the balance of trade in our favour, and thereby fetch the money back again." End of footnote. Footnote. That the price of each single kind of commodity forms a part of the sum of the prices of all the commodities in circulation is a self-evident proposition. But how use values, which are incommensurable with regard to each other, are to be exchanged en masse for the total sum of gold and silver in a country, is quite incomprehensible. If we start from the notion that all commodities together form one single commodity, of which each is but an aliquot part, we get the following beautiful result. The total commodity equals X hundredweight of gold. Commodity A equals an aliquot part of the total commodity, equals the same aliquot part of X hundredweight of gold. This is stated in all seriousness by Montesquieu. If one compares the amount of gold and silver in the world with the sum of the commodities available, it is certain that each product or commodity, taken in isolation, could be compared with a certain portion of the total amount of money. Let us suppose that there is only one product, or commodity, in the world, or only one that can be purchased, and that it can be divided in the same way as money. A certain part of this commodity would then correspond to a part of the total amount of money. Half the total of the one would correspond to half the total of the other, etc. The determination of the prices of things always depends, fundamentally, on the relation between the total amount of things and the total amount of their monetary symbols. Montesquieu. As to the further development of this theory by Ricardo and his disciples, James Mill, Lord Overstone, and others, see Zur Kritik, etc. John Stuart Mill, with his usual eclectic logic, understands how to hold at the same time the view of his father, James Mill, and the opposite view. On a comparison of the text of his compendium, Principles of Political Economy, with his preface to the first edition, in which preface he announces himself as the Adam Smith of his day, we do not know whether to admire more the simplicity of the man, or that of the public who took him in good faith for the Adam Smith he announced himself to be. Although he bears about as much resemblance to Adam Smith as, say, General Williams of Kars to the Duke of Wellington. The original researches of Mr. J. S. Mill, which are neither extensive nor profound in the domain of political economy, will be found mustered in rank and file in his little work, Some Unsettled Questions of Political Economy, which appeared in 1844. Locke asserts point-blank the connection between the absence of value in gold and silver and the determination of their values by quantity alone. Mankind, having consented to put an imaginary value upon gold and silver, the intrinsic value regarded in these metals is nothing but the quantity. Some Considerations, etc., 1691. End of footnote. C. Coin and Symbols of Value. That money takes the shape of coin springs from its function as the circulating medium. The weight of gold, represented in imagination by the prices or money names of commodities, must confront those commodities within the circulation in the shape of coins or pieces of gold of a given denomination. Coining, like the establishment of a standard of prices, is the business of the state. The different national uniforms worn at home by gold and silver as coins, and doffed again in the market of the world, indicate the separation between the internal or national spheres of the circulation of commodities and their universal sphere. The only difference, therefore, between coin and bullion is one of shape, and gold can at any time pass from one form to the other. Footnote. It lies, of course, entirely beyond my purpose to take into consideration such details as the seigniorage on minting. I will, however, cite for the benefit of the romantic sycophant Adam Muller, who admires the generous liberality with which the English government coins gratuitously, the following opinion of Sir Dudley North. Silver and gold, like other commodities, have their ebbings and flowings. Upon the arrival of quantities from Spain, it is carried into the Tower and coined. Not long after, there will come a demand for bullion to be exported again. If there is none, but all happens to be in coin, what then? Melt it down again. There's no loss in it, for the coining costs the owner nothing. Thus the nation has been abused, and made to pay for the twisting of straw for asses to eat. If the merchant were made to pay the price of the coinage, he would not have sent his silver to the Tower without consideration, and coined money would always keep a value above uncoined silver. North. North was himself one of the foremost merchants in the reign of Charles II. End of footnote. But no sooner does coin leave the mint than it immediately finds itself on the high road to the melting pot. During their currency, coins wear away, some more, others less. Name and substance, nominal weight and real weight, begin their process of separation. Coins of the same denomination become different in value because they are different in weight. The weight of gold, fixed upon as the standard of prices, deviates from the weight that serves as the circulating medium, and the latter thereby ceases any longer to be a real equivalent of the commodities whose prices it realizes. The history of coinage during the Middle Ages, and down into the 18th century, records the ever-renewed confusion arising from this cause. The natural tendency of circulation to convert coins into a mere semblance of what they profess to be, into a symbol of the weight of metal they are officially supposed to contain, is recognized by modern legislation, which fixes the loss of weight sufficient to demonetize a gold coin, or to make it no longer legal tender. The fact that the currency of coins itself effects a separation between their nominal and their real weight, creating a distinction between them as mere pieces of metal on the one hand, and as coins with a definite function on the other. This fact implies the latent possibility of replacing metallic coins by tokens of some other material, by symbols serving the same purposes as coins. The practical difficulties in the way of coining extremely minute quantities of gold or silver, and the circumstance that at first the less precious metal is used as a measure of value instead of the more precious, copper instead of silver, silver instead of gold, and that the less precious circulates as money until dethroned by the more precious, all these facts explain the parts historically played by silver and copper tokens as substitutes for gold coins. Silver and copper tokens take the place of gold in those regions of the circulation where coins pass from hand to hand most rapidly, and are subject to the maximum amount of wear and tear. This occurs where sales and purchases on a very small scale are continually happening. In order to prevent these satellites from establishing themselves permanently in the place of gold, positive enactments determine the extent to which they must be compulsorily received as payment instead of gold. The particular tracks pursued by the different species of coin in currency run naturally into each other. The tokens keep company with the gold to pay fractional parts of the smallest gold coin. Gold is, on the one hand, constantly pouring into retail circulation, and on the other hand is as constantly being thrown out again by being changed into tokens. Footnote. If silver never exceed what is wanted for the smaller payments, it cannot be collected in sufficient quantities for the larger payments. The use of gold in the main payments necessarily implies also its use in the retail trade. Those who have gold coin offering them for small purchases, and receiving with the commodity purchased a balance of silver in return, by which means the surplus of silver that would otherwise encumber the retail dealer, is drawn off and dispersed into general circulation. But if there is as much silver as will transact the small payments independent of gold, the retail trader must then receive silver for small purchases, and it must of necessity accumulate in his hands. David Buchanan, Inquiry into the Taxation and Commercial Policy of Great Britain, Edinburgh, 1844. The weight of metal in the silver and copper tokens is arbitrarily fixed by law. When in currency, they wear away even more rapidly than gold coins. Hence their functions are totally independent of their weight, and consequently of all value. The function of gold as coin becomes completely independent of the metallic value of that gold. Therefore, things that are relatively without value, such as paper notes, can serve as coins in its place. This purely symbolic character is to a certain extent masked in metal tokens. In paper money, it stands out plainly. In fact, ce n'est que le premier pas qui coûte. We allude here only to inconvertible paper money issued by the state and having compulsory circulation. It has its immediate origin in the metallic currency. Money based upon credit implies, on the other hand, conditions which, from our standpoint of the simple circulation of commodities, are as yet totally unknown to us. But we may affirm this much, that just as true paper money takes its rise in the function of money as the circulating medium, so money based upon credit takes root spontaneously in the function of money as the means of payment. Footnote. The Mandarin Wan Mao In, the Chinese Chancellor of the Exchequer, took it into his head one day to lay before the Son of Heaven a proposal that secretly aimed at converting the assignats of the empire into convertible banknotes. The Assignats Committee, in its report of April 1854, gives him a severe snubbing. Whether he also received the traditional drubbing with bamboos is not stated. The concluding part of the report is as follows. The committee has carefully examined his proposal and finds that it is entirely in favour of the merchants, and that no advantage will result to the crown. Arbeiten der Kaiserlich Russischen Gesandtschaft zu Peking über China. Aus dem Russischen von Dr. K. Abel and F. A. Mecklenburg, Erster Band, Berlin, 1858. In his evidence before the Committee of the House of Lords on the Bank Acts, a governor of the Bank of England says, with regard to the abrasion of gold coins during currency, "Every year a fresh class of sovereigns becomes too light. The class which one year passes with full weight loses enough by wear and tear to draw the scales next year against it." House of Lords Committee, 1848. End of footnote. The state puts in circulation bits of paper on which their various denominations, say £1, £5, etc., are printed. Insofar as they actually take the place of gold to the same amount, their movement is subject to the laws that regulate the currency of money itself. A law peculiar to the circulation of paper money can spring up only from the proportion in which that paper money represents gold. Such a law exists. Stated simply, it is as follows. The issue of paper money must not exceed in amount the gold, or silver as the case may be, which would actually circulate if not replaced by symbols. Now the quantity of gold which the circulation can absorb constantly fluctuates about a given level. Still, the mass of the circulating medium in a given country never sinks below a certain minimum easily ascertained by actual experience. The fact that this minimum mass continually undergoes changes in its constituent parts, or that the pieces of gold of which it consists are being constantly replaced by fresh ones, causes, of course, no change either in its amount or in the continuity of its circulation. It can therefore be replaced by paper symbols. If, on the other hand, all the conduits of circulation were today filled with paper money to the full extent of their capacity for absorbing money, they might tomorrow be overflowing in consequence of a fluctuation in the circulation of commodities. There would no longer be any standard. If the paper money exceed its proper limit, which is the amount in gold coins of the like denomination that can actually be current, it would, apart from the danger of falling into general disrepute, represent only that quantity of gold which, in accordance with the laws of the circulation of commodities, is required and is alone capable of being represented by paper. If the quantity of paper money issued be double what it ought to be, then, as a matter of fact, £1 would be the money name not of 1/4 of an ounce, but of 1/8 of an ounce of gold. The effect would be the same as if an alteration had taken place in the function of gold as a standard of prices. Those values that were previously expressed by the price of £1 would now be expressed by the price of £2. Paper money is a token representing gold or money. The relation between it and the values of commodities is this, that the latter are ideally expressed in the same quantities of gold that are symbolically represented by the paper. Only in so far as paper money represents gold, which like all other commodities has value, is it a symbol of value. Footnote. The following passage from Fullerton, shows the want of clearness on the part of even the best writers on money in their comprehension of its various functions. That, as far as concerns our domestic exchanges, all the monetary functions which are usually performed by gold and silver coins may be performed as effectually by a circulation of inconvertible notes, paying no value but that factitious and conventional value they derive from the law, is a fact which admits, I conceive, of no denial. Value of this description may be made to answer all the purposes of intrinsic value, and supersede even the necessity for a standard, provided only the quantity of issues be kept under due limitation. Fullerton, Regulation of Currencies, London, 1845. Because the commodity that serves as money is capable of being replaced in circulation by mere symbols of value, therefore its functions as a measure of value and a standard of prices are declared to be superfluous. End of footnote. Finally, someone may ask why gold is capable of being replaced by tokens that have no value. But as we have already seen, it is capable of being replaced only in so far as it functions exclusively as coin, or as the circulating medium, and as nothing else. Now money has other functions besides this one, and the isolated function of serving as the mere circulating medium is not necessarily the only one attached to gold coin, although this is the case with those abraded coins that continue to circulate. Each piece of money is a mere coin, or means of circulation, only so long as it actually circulates. But this is just the case with that minimum mass of gold, which is capable of being replaced by paper money. That mass remains constantly within the sphere of circulation, continually functions as a circulating medium, and exists exclusively for that purpose. Its movement, therefore, represents nothing but the continued alternation of the inverse phases of the metamorphosis commodity to money to commodity, phases in which commodities confront their value forms, only to disappear again immediately. The independent existence of the exchange value of a commodity here is a transient apparition, by means of which the commodity is immediately replaced by another commodity. Hence, in this process which continually makes money pass from hand to hand, the mere symbolical existence of money suffices. Its functional existence absorbs, so to say, its material existence. Being a transient and objective reflex of the prices of commodities, it serves only as a symbol of itself, and is therefore capable of being replaced by a token. Footnote. From the fact that gold and silver, so far as they are coins, or exclusively serve as the medium of circulation, become mere tokens of themselves, Nicolas Barbon deduces the right of governments to raise money, that is, to give to the weight of silver that is called a shilling the name of a greater weight, such as a crown, and so to pay creditors shillings instead of crowns. Money does wear and grow lighter by often telling over. It is the denomination and currency of the money that men regard in bargaining, and not the quantity of silver. 'Tis the public authority upon the metal that makes it money. N. Barbon. End of footnote. One thing is, however, requisite. This token must have an objective social validity of its own, and this the paper symbol acquires by its forced currency. This compulsory action of the state can take effect only within that inner sphere of circulation which is coterminous with the territories of the community, but it is also only within that sphere that money completely responds to its function of being the circulating medium, or becomes coin.